now we're getting into another area I wanted to discuss, and that's this whole business about heaven and hell. From what I'm gathering here, there's no such thing as hell.
There is hell, but it is not what you think. And you do not experience it for the reasons you've been given.
What is hell?
It is the experience of the worst possible outcome of your choices, decisions, and creations. It is the natural consequence of any thought which denies me or says no to who you are in relationship to me. It is the pain you suffer through wrong thinking. Yet even the term wrong thinking is a misnomer, because there is no such thing as that which is wrong. Hell is the opposite of joy. It is unfulfillment. It is knowing who and what you are and failing to experience that. This being less, that is hell. And there is none greater for your soul. And hell does not exist as this place you have fantasized, where you burn in some everlasting fire, or exist in some state of everlasting torment. What purpose could I have in that? Even if I did hold the extraordinarily ungodly thought that you did not deserve heaven, why would I have a need to seek some kind of revenge or punishment for your failing? Wouldn't it be a simple matter for me to just dispose of you? What vengeful part of me would require that I subject you to eternal suffering of a type and at a level beyond description? If you answer, the need for justice, would not a simple denial of communion with me in heaven serve the ends of justice? Is the unending infliction of pain also required? I tell you, there is no such experience after death as you have constructed in your fear-based theologies. Yet there is an experience of the soul so unhappy, so incomplete, so less than whole, so separated from God's greatest joy, that to your soul this would be hell. But I tell you, I do not send you there, nor do I cause this experience to be visited upon you. You yourself create the experience, whenever and however you separate yourself from your own highest thought about you. You yourself create the experience, whenever you deny yourself, whenever you reject who and what you really are. Yet even this experience is never eternal. It cannot be, for it is not my plan that you shall be separated from me forever and ever. Indeed, such a thing is an impossibility. For to achieve such an event, not only would you have to deny who you are, I would have to as well. This I will never do. And so long as one of us holds the truth about you, the truth about you shall ultimately prevail.
But if there is no hell, does that mean that I can do what I want, act as I wish, commit any act without fear of retribution?
Is it fear that you need in order to be, do, and have what is intrinsically right? Must you be threatened in order to be good? What is being good? Who gets to have the final say about that? Who sets the guidelines? Who makes the rules? I tell you this, you are your own rule maker. You set the guidelines. And you decide how well you have done, how well you are doing. But you are the one who has decided who and what you really are, and who you want to be. And you are the only one who can assess how well you're doing. No one else will judge you ever, for why and how could God judge God's own creation and call it bad? If I wanted you to be and do everything perfectly, I would have left you in the state of total perfection whence you came. The whole point of the process was for you to discover yourself, create yourself, as you truly are, and as you truly wish to be. Yet you could not be that unless you also had a choice to be something else. Should I therefore punish you for making a choice that I myself have laid before you? If I did not want you to make the second choice, why would I create other than the first? This is a question you must ask yourself before you would assign me the role of a condemning God. The direct answer to your question is yes, you may do as you wish without fear of retribution. It may serve you, however, to be aware of consequences. Consequences are results, natural outcomes. These are not at all the same as retributions or punishments. Outcomes are simply that. They are what results from the natural application of natural laws. They are that which occurs quite predictably as a consequence of what has occurred. All physical life functions in accordance with natural laws. Once you remember these laws and apply them, you have mastered life at the physical level. What seems like punishment to you, or what you would call evil or bad luck, is nothing more than a natural law asserting itself.
Then if I were to know these laws and obey them, I would never have a moment's trouble again. Is that what you're telling me?
You would never experience yourself as being what you call trouble. You would not understand any life situation to be a problem. You would not encounter any circumstance with trepidation. You would put an end to all worry, doubt, and fear. You would live as you fantasized Adam and Eve lived, not as disembodied spirits in the realm of the absolute, but as embodied spirits in the realm of the relative. Yet you would have all the freedom, all the joy, all the peace, and all the wisdom, understanding, and power of the spirit you are. You would be a fully realized being. This is the goal of your soul. This is its purpose, to fully realize itself while in the body, to become the embodiment of all that it really is. This is my plan for you. This is my ideal, that I should become realized through you. That thus, concept is turned into experience, that I might know myself experientially. The laws of the universe are laws that I laid down. They are perfect laws, creating perfect function of the physical. Have you ever seen anything more perfect than a snowflake? Its intricacy, its design, its symmetry, its conformity to itself and originality from all else, all are a mystery. You wonder at the miracle of this awesome display of nature. Yet if I can do this with a single snowflake, what think you I can do, have done, with the universe? Were you to see the symmetry of it, the perfection of its design, from the largest body to the smallest particle, you would not be able to hold the truth of it in your reality. Even now, as you get glimpses of it, you cannot yet imagine or understand its implications. Yet you can know there are implications, far more complex and far more extraordinary than your present comprehension can embrace. Shakespeare said it wonderfully. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Then how can I know these laws? How can I learn them?
It is not a question of learning, but of remembering.
How can I remember them?
Begin by being still. Quiet the outer world, so that the inner world might bring you sight. This insight is what you seek. That you cannot have it while you are so deeply concerned with your outer reality. Seek, therefore, to go within as much as possible. And when you are not going within, come from within as you deal with the outside world. Remember this axiom. If you do not go within, you go without. Put it in the first person as you repeat it to make it more personal. If I do not go within, I go without. You have been going without all your life, yet you do not have to and never did. There is nothing you cannot be, there is nothing you cannot do, there is nothing you cannot have.
Well, that sounds like a pie-in-the-sky promise.
What other kind of promise would you have God make? Would you believe me if I promised you less? For thousands of years, people have disbelieved the promises of God for the most extraordinary reason. They were too good to be true. So you have chosen a lesser promise, a lesser love. For the highest promise of God proceeds from the highest love. Yet you cannot conceive of a perfect love, and so a perfect promise is also inconceivable, as is a perfect person. Therefore, you cannot believe even in yourself. Failing to believe in any of this means failure to believe in God. For belief in God produces belief in God's greatest gift, unconditional love, and God's greatest promise, unlimited potential.
May I interrupt you here? I hate to interrupt God when he's on a roll, but I've heard this talk of unlimited potential before, and it doesn't square with the human experience. Forget the difficulties encountered by the average person. What about the challenges of those born with mental or physical limitations? Is their potential unlimited?
You have written so in your own scripture, in many ways and in many places.
Give me one reference.
Look to see what you have written in Genesis chapter 11, verse 6 of your Bible.
It says, And the Lord said, Behold, the people are one, and they have all one language. And this is only... And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do.
Yes. Now, can you trust that?
That does not answer the question of the feeble, the infirm, the handicapped, those who are limited.
You think they are limited, as you put it, not of their choice? Do you imagine that the human soul encounters life challenges, whatever they may be, by accident? Is this your imagining?
Do you mean that a soul chooses what kind of life it will experience ahead of time?
No. That would defeat the purpose of the encounter. The purpose is to create your own experience and thus create yourself in the glorious moment of now. You do not therefore choose the life you will experience ahead of time. You may, however, select the persons, places, and events, the conditions and circumstances, the challenges and obstacles, the opportunities and options with which to create your experience. You may select the colors for your palette, the tools for your chest, the machinery for your shop. What you create with these is your business. That is the business of life. Your potential is unlimited in all that you've chosen to do. Do not assume that a soul which has been incarnated in a body which you call limited has not reached its full potential, for you do not know what that soul was trying to do. You do not understand its agenda. You are unclear as to its intent. Therefore, bless every person and condition and give thanks. Thus you affirm the perfection of God's creation and show your faith in it. For nothing happens by accident in God's world, and there is no such thing as coincidence. Nor is the world buffeted by random choice or something you call fate. If a snowflake is utterly perfect in its design, do you not think the same could be said about something as magnificent as your life?
But even Jesus healed the sick. Why would he heal them if their condition was so perfect?
Jesus did not heal those he healed because he saw their condition as imperfect. He healed those he healed because he saw those souls asking for healing as part of their process. He saw the perfection of the process. He recognized and understood the soul's intention. Jesus felt that all illness, mental or physical, represented imperfection. Would he not have simply healed everyone on the planet all at once? Do you doubt that he could do this?
No, I believe he could have.
Good. Then the mind begs to know, why did he not do it? Why would the Christ choose to have some suffer and others be healed? For that matter, why does God allow any suffering at any time? This question has been asked before, and the answer remains the same. There is perfection in the process. And all life arises out of choice. It is not appropriate to interfere with choice or to question it. It is particularly inappropriate to condemn it. What is appropriate is to observe it and then to do whatever might be done to assist the soul in seeking and making a higher choice. Be watchful, therefore, of the choices of others, but not judgmental. Know that their choice is perfect for them in this moment now. Yet stand ready to assist them should the moment come when they seek a newer choice, a different choice, a higher choice. Move into communion with the souls of others and their purpose. Their intention will be clear to you. This is what Jesus did with those he healed and with all those whose lives he touched. Jesus healed all those who came to him or who sent others to him, supplicating for them. He did not perform a random healing. To have done so would have been to violate a sacred law of the universe. Allow each soul to walk its path.
But does that mean we must not help anyone without being asked? Surely not. Or we would never be able to help the starving children of India, or the tortured masses of Africa, or the poor, or the downtrodden anywhere. All humanitarian effort would be lost, all charity forbidden. Must we wait for an individual to cry out to us in desperation, or for a nation of people to plead for help, before we're allowed to do what is obviously right?
You see, the question answers itself. The thing is obviously right. Do it. Remember to exercise extreme judgment regarding what you call right and wrong. A thing is only right or wrong because you say it is. A thing is not right or wrong intrinsically.
It isn't.
Rightness or wrongness is a subjective judgment in a personal value system. By your subjective judgments do you create yourself. By your personal values do you determine and demonstrate who you are. The world exists exactly as it is so that you may make these judgments. If the world existed in perfect condition, your life process of self-creation would be terminated. It would end. A lawyer's career would end tomorrow were there no more litigation. A doctor's career would end tomorrow were there no more illness. A philosopher's career would end tomorrow were there no more questions.
And God's career would end tomorrow were there no more problems.
Precisely. You've put it perfectly. We, all of us, would be through creating were there nothing more to create. We, all of us, have a vested interest in keeping the game going. Much as we all say we would like to solve all the problems, we dare not solve all the problems, or there will be nothing left for us to do. Your industrial-military complex understands this very well. That is why it opposes mightily any attempt to install a war no more government anywhere. Your medical establishment understands this too. That is why it staunchly opposes. It must, it has to, for its own survival, any new miracle drug or cure, to say nothing of the possibility of miracles themselves. Your religious community also holds this clarity. That is why it attacks uniformly any definition of God, which does not include fear, judgment, and retribution, and any definition of self, which does not include their own idea of the only path to God. If I say to you, you are God, where does that leave religion? If I say to you, you are healed, where does that leave science and medicine? If I say to you, you shall live in peace, where does that leave the peacemakers? If I say to you, the world is fixed, where does that leave the world? What now of plumbers? The world is filled with essentially two kinds of people. Those who give you things you want and those who fix things. In a sense, even those who simply give you things you want, the butchers, the bakers, the candlestick makers, are also fixers. For to have a desire for something is often to have a need for it. That is why addicts are said to need a fix. Be careful, therefore, that desire not become addiction.
Are you saying the world will always have problems? Are you saying that you actually want it that way?
I am saying that the world exists the way it exists, just as a snowflake exists the way it exists, quite by design. You have created it that way, just as you have created your life exactly as it is. I want what you want. The day you really want an end to hunger,
there will be no more hunger. I have given you all the resources with which to do that. You have all the tools with which to make that choice. You have not made it. Not because you cannot make it. The world could end world hunger tomorrow. You choose not to make it. You claim that there are good reasons that 40,000 people a day must die of hunger. There are no good reasons. Yet, at a time when you say you can do nothing to stop 40,000 people a day from dying of hunger, you bring 50,000 people a day into your world to begin a new life. And this you call love. This you call God's plan. It is a plan which totally lacks logic or reason, to say nothing of compassion. I am showing you in stark terms that the world exists the way it exists because you have chosen for it to. You are systematically destroying your own environment, then pointing to so-called natural disasters as evidence of God's cruel hoax or nature's harsh ways. You have played the hoax on yourself, and it is your ways which are cruel. Nothing, nothing is more gentle than nature. And nothing, nothing has been more cruel to nature than man. Yet you step aside from all involvement in this, deny all responsibility. It is not your fault, you say. And in this you are right. It is not a question of fault. It is a matter of choice. You can choose to end the destruction of your rainforests tomorrow. You can choose to stop depleting the protective layer hovering over your planet. You can choose to discontinue the ongoing onslaught of your Earth's ingenious ecosystem. You can seek to put the snowflake back together or at least to halt its inexorable melting. But will you do it? You can similarly end all war tomorrow. Simply, easily. All it takes, all it has ever taken, is for all of you to agree. Yet if you cannot all agree on something as basically simple as ending the killing of each other, how can you call upon the heavens with shaking fist to put your life in order? I will do nothing for you that you will not do for yourself. That is the law and the prophets. The world is in the condition it is in because of you and the choices you have made or failed to make. Not to decide is to decide. The earth is in the shape it's in because of you and the choices you have made or failed to make. Your own life is the way it is because of you and the choices you have made or failed to make.
But I did not choose to get hit by that truck. I did not choose to get mugged by that robber or raped by that maniac. People could say that, because there are people in the world who could say that.
You are all at root cause for the conditions which exist, which create in the robber the desire or the perceived need to steal. You have all created the consciousness which makes rape possible. It is when you see in yourself that which caused the crime that you begin at last to heal the condition from which it sprang. Feed your hungry. Give dignity to your poor. Grant opportunity to your less fortunate. End the prejudice which keeps masses huddled and angry with little promise of a better tomorrow. Put away your pointless taboos and restrictions upon sexual energy. Rather, help others to truly understand its wonder and to channel it properly. Do these things, and you will go a long way toward ending robbery and rape forever. As for the so-called accident, the truck coming around the bend, the brick falling from the sky, learn to greet each such incident as a small part of a larger mosaic. You have come here to work out an individual plan for your own salvation. Yet salvation does not mean saving yourself from the snares of the devil. There is no such thing as the devil, and hell does not exist. You are saving yourself from the oblivion of non-realization. You cannot lose in this battle. You cannot fail. Thus, it is not a battle at all, but simply a process. Yet if you do not know this, you will see it as a constant struggle. You may even believe in the struggle long enough to create a whole religion around it. This religion will teach that struggle is the point of it all. This is a false teaching. It is in not struggling that the process proceeds. It is in surrendering that the victory is won. Accidents happen because they do. Certain elements of the life process have come together in a particular way at a particular time with particular results. Results which you choose to call unfortunate for your own particular reasons. Yet they may not be unfortunate at all, given the agenda of your soul. I tell you this, there is no coincidence, and nothing happens by accident. Each event and adventure is called to yourself by yourself in order that you might create and experience who you really are. All true masters know this. That is why mystic masters remain unperturbed in the face of the worst experiences of life, as you would define them. The great teachers of your Christian religion understand this. They know that Jesus was not perturbed by the crucifixion, but expected it. He could have walked away, but he did not. He could have stopped the process at any point. He had that power. Yet he did not. He allowed himself to be crucified in order that he might stand as man's eternal salvation. "Look," he said, "at what I can do. Look at what is true. and know that these things and more shall you also do. For have I not said, ye are gods? Yet you do not believe. If you cannot, then believe in yourself. Believe in me. Such was Jesus' compassion that he begged for a way and created it to so impact the world that all might come to heaven, self-realization, if in no other way than through him. For he defeated misery and death, and so might you. The grandest teaching of Christ was not that you shall have everlasting life, but that you do. Not that you shall have brotherhood in God, but that you do. Not that you shall have whatever you request, but that you do. All that is required is to know this, for you are the creator of your own reality, and life can show up no other way for you than that way in which you think it will. You think it into being. This is the first step in creation. God the Father is thought. Your thought is the parent which gives birth to all things.
This is one of the laws we are to remember.
Yes.
Can you tell me others?
I've told you others. I've told you them all since the beginning of time. Over and over I've told you them. Teacher after teacher have I sent you. You do not listen to my teachers. You kill them.
But why? Why do we kill the holiest among us? We kill them or dishonor them, which is the same thing. Why?
Because they stand against every thought you have that would deny me. And deny me you must if you are to deny yourself.
Why would I want to deny you or me?
Because you're afraid. And because my promises are too good to be true. Because you cannot accept the grandest truth. And so you must reduce yourself to a spirituality which teaches fear and dependence and intolerance rather than love and power and acceptance. You're filled with fear. And your biggest fear is that my biggest promise might be life's biggest lie. And so you create the biggest fantasy you can to defend yourself against this. You claim that any promise which gives you the power and guarantees you the love of God must be the false promise of the devil. God would never make such a promise, you tell yourself. Only the devil would, to tempt you into denying God's true identity as the fearsome, judgmental, jealous, vengeful, and punishing entity of entities. Even though this description better fits the definition of a devil, if there were one. You have assigned devilish characteristics to God in order to convince yourself not to accept the godlike promises of your Creator or the godlike qualities of the self. Such is the power of fear.
I'm trying to let go of my fear. Will you tell me again more of the laws?
The first law is that you can be, do, and have whatever you can imagine. The second law is that you attract what you fear.
Why is that?
Emotion is the power which attracts. That which you fear strongly, you will experience. An animal, which you consider a lower form of life, even though animals act with more integrity and greater consistency than humans, knows immediately if you are afraid of it. Plants, which you consider an even lower form of life, respond to people who love them far better than to those who couldn't care less. None of this is by coincidence. There is no coincidence in the universe. Only a grand design, an incredible snowflake. Emotion is energy in motion. When you move energy, you create effect. If you move enough energy, you create matter. Matter is energy conglomerated, moved around, shoved together. If you manipulate energy long enough in a certain way, you get matter. Every master understands this law. It's the alchemy of the universe. It's the secret of all life. Thought is pure energy. Every thought you have ever had, and ever will have is creative. The energy of your thought never, ever dies. Ever. It leaves your being and heads out into the universe, extending forever. A thought is forever. All thoughts congeal. All thoughts meet other thoughts, crisscrossing in an incredible maze of energy, forming an ever-changing pattern of unspeakable beauty and unbelievable complexity. Like energy attracts like energy, forming, to use simple words, clumps of energy of like kind. When enough similar clumps crisscross each other, run into each other, they stick to each other. To use another simple term, it takes an incomprehensibly huge amount of similar energy sticking together thusly to form matter. But matter will form out of pure energy. In fact, that is the only way it can form. Once energy becomes matter, it remains matter for a very long time, unless its construction is disrupted by an opposing or dissimilar form of energy. This dissimilar energy, acting upon matter, actually dismembers the matter, releasing the raw energy of which it was composed. This is, in elementary terms, the theory behind your atomic bomb. Einstein came closer than any other human being, before or since, to discovering, explaining, and functionalizing the creative secret of the universe. You should now better understand how people of like mind can work together to create a favored reality. The phrase, wherever two or more are gathered in my name, becomes much more meaningful. Of course, when entire societies think a certain way, very often astonishing things happen, not all of them necessarily desirable. For instance, a society living in fear very often, actually, inevitably, produces in form that which it fears most. Similarly, large communities, congregations, often find miracle-producing power in combined thinking, or what some people call common prayer. And it must be made clear that even individuals, if their thought, prayer, hope, wish, dream, fear, is amazingly strong, can, in and of themselves, produce such results. Jesus did this regularly. He understood how to manipulate energy and matter, how to rearrange it, how to redistribute it, how to utterly control it. Many masters have known this. Many know it now. You can know it right now. This is the knowledge of good and evil of which Adam and Eve partook. Until they understood this, there could be no life as you know it. Adam and Eve, the mythical names you have given to represent first man and first woman, were the father and mother of the human experience. What has been described as the fall of Adam was actually his upliftment, the greatest single event in the history of humankind. For without it, the world of relativity would not exist. The act of Adam and Eve was not original sin, but in truth, first blessing. You should thank them from the bottom of your hearts, for in being the first to make a wrong choice, Adam and Eve produced the possibility of making any choice at all. In your mythology, you have made Eve the bad one, the temptress who ate of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, and coyly invited Adam to join her. This mythological setup has allowed you to make woman man's downfall ever since, resulting in all manner of warped realities, not to mention distorted sexual views and confusions. How can you feel so good about something so bad? What you most fear is what will most plague you. Fear will draw it to you like a magnet. All your holy scriptures of every religious persuasion and tradition which you have created contain the clear admonition, fear not. Do you think this is an accident? The laws are very simple. Thought is creative. Fear attracts like energy. Love is all there is.
Oops, she got me on that third one. How can love be all there is if fear attracts like energy?
Love is the ultimate reality. It is the only, the all. The feeling of love is your experience of God. In highest truth, love is all there is, all there was, and all there ever will be. When you move into the absolute, you move into love. The realm of the relative was created in order that I might experience myself. This has already been explained to you. This does not make the realm of the relative real. It is a created reality you and I have devised and continue to devise in order that we may know ourselves experientially. Yet the creation can seem very real. Its purpose is to seem so real we accept it as truly existing. In this way, God has contrived to create something else other than itself. Though in strictest terms, this is impossible since God is I am. All that is. In creating something else, namely the realm of the relative, I have produced an environment in which you may choose to be God rather than simply being told that you are God, in which you may experience Godhead as an act of creation rather than a conceptualization in which the little candle and the sun, the littlest soul, can know itself as the light. Fear is the other end of love. It is the primal polarity. In creating the realm of the relative, I first created the opposite of myself. Now, in the realm in which you live on the physical plane, there are only two places of being, fear and love. Thoughts rooted in fear will produce one kind of manifestation on the physical plane. Thoughts rooted in love will produce another. The masters who have walked the planet are those who have discovered the secret of the relative world and refuse to acknowledge its reality. In short, masters are those who have chosen only love. In every instance, in every moment, in every circumstance, even as they were being killed, they loved their murderers. Even as they were being persecuted, they loved their oppressors. This is very difficult for you to understand, much less emulate. Nevertheless, it is what every master has ever done. It doesn't matter what the philosophy, it doesn't matter what the tradition, it doesn't matter what the religion. It is what every master has done. This example and this lesson has been laid out so clearly for you, time and time again, over and over has it been shown to you. Through all the ages and in every place, through all your lifetimes and in every moment, the universe has used every contrivance to place this truth before you in song and story, in poetry and dance, in words and in motion, in pictures of motion, which you call motion pictures, and in collections of words, which you call books. From the highest mountain, it has been shouted. In the lowest place, its whisper has been heard. Through the corridors of all human experience has this truth been echoed. Love is the answer. Yet you have not listened. Now come you to this conversation, asking God again what God has told you countless times in countless ways. Yet I will tell you again, here. Will you listen now? Will you truly hear? What do you think brought you to this? How does it come to pass that you are listening to this? Do you think I know not what I am doing? There are no coincidences in the universe. I have heard the crying of your heart. I have seen the searching of your soul. I know how deeply you have desired the truth. In pain have you called out for it, and in joy. Unendingly have you beseeched me. Show myself. Explain myself. Reveal myself. I am doing so here, in terms so plain, you cannot misunderstand. In language so simple, you cannot be confused. In vocabulary so common, you cannot get lost in the verbiage. So go ahead now. Ask me anything. Anything. I will contrive to bring you the answer. The whole universe will I use to do this, so be on the lookout. This is far from my only tool. You may ask a question, then put this down, but watch, listen. The words to the next song you hear, the information in the next article you read, the storyline of the next movie you watch, the chance utterance of the next person you meet, or the whisper of the next river, the next ocean, the next breeze that caresses your ear. All these devices are mine. All these avenues are open to me. I will speak to you if you will listen. I will come to you if you will invite me. I will show you then that I have always been there, always.
Talking to myself.
You are.
That does not seem like what a communication with God would feel like.
You want bells and whistles? I'll see what I can arrange.
You know, don't you, that there are those who will call this a blasphemy, especially if you keep showing up as such a wise guy.
Let me explain something to you. You have this idea that God shows up in only one way in life. That's a very dangerous idea. It stops you from seeing God all over. If you think God looks only one way or sounds only one way or is only one way, you're going to look right past me night and day. You'll spend your whole life looking for God and not finding her because you're looking for a him. I use this as an example. It has been said that if you don't see God in the profane and the profound, you're missing half the story. That is a great truth. God is in the sadness and the laughter. In the bitter and the sweet, there is a divine purpose behind everything, and therefore a divine presence in everything.
Well, I once began writing a book called God is a Salami Sandwich.
That would have been a very good book. I gave you that inspiration. Why didn't you write it?
Well, it felt like blasphemy, or at the very least, horribly irreverent.
You mean wonderfully irreverent. What gave you the idea that God is only reverent? God is the up and the down, the hot and the cold, the left and the right, the reverent and the irreverent. Think you that God cannot laugh? Did you imagine that God doesn't enjoy a good joke? Is it your knowing that God is without humor? I tell you, God invented humor. Must you speak in hushed tones when you speak to me? Are slang words or tough language outside my ken? I tell you, you can speak to me as you would speak with your best friend. Do you think there is a word I haven't heard? A sight I have not seen? A sound I do not know? Is it your thought that I despise some of these, while I love the others? I tell you, I despise nothing. None of it is repulsive to me. It's life, and life is the gift. The unspeakable treasure, the holy of holies. I am life, for I am the stuff life is. Its every aspect has a divine purpose. Nothing exists, nothing, without a reason understood and approved by God.
How can this be? How can this be? What of the evil which has been created by man?
You cannot create a thing, not a thought, an object, an event, no experience of any kind, which is outside of God's plan. For God's plan is for you to create anything, everything, whatever you want. In such freedom lies the experience of God being God. And this is the experience for which I created you, and life itself. Evil is that which you call evil, yet even that I love. For it is only through that which you call evil that you can know good. Only through that which you call the work of the devil that you can know and do the work of God. I do not love hot more than I love cold, high more than low, left more than right. It's all relative. It is all part of what is. I do not love good more than I love bad. Hitler went to heaven. When you understand this, you will understand God.
But I have been raised to believe that good and bad do exist, that right and wrong are opposed, that some things are just not okay, not all right, not acceptable in the sight of God.
Everything is acceptable in the sight of God, for how can God not accept that which is? To reject a thing is to deny that it exists. To say that it is not okay is to say that it is not a part of me, and that's impossible. Yet, hold to your beliefs and stay true to your values, for these are the values of your parents, of your parents' parents, of your friends, and of your society. They form the structure of your life, and to lose them would be to unravel the fabric of your experience. Still, examine them one by one. Review them piece by piece. Do not dismantle the house, but look at each brick and replace those which appear broken, which no longer support the structure. Your ideas about right and wrong are just that, ideas. They are the thoughts which form the shape and create the substance of who you are. There would be only one reason to change any of these, only one purpose in making an alteration, if you are not happy with who you are. Only you can know if you are happy. Only you can say of your life, this is my creation in which I am well pleased. If your values serve you, hold to them, argue for them, fight to defend them. Yet seek to fight in a way which harms no one. Harm is not a necessary ingredient in healing.
You know, you say hold to your values at the same time you say our values are all wrong. Help me with this.
I have not said your values are wrong. But neither are they right. They're simply judgments, assessments, decisions. For the most part, they are decisions made not by you, but by someone else. Your parents, perhaps, your religion, your teachers, historians, politicians. Very few of the value judgments you have incorporated into your truth are judgments you yourself have made based on your own experience. Yet experience is what you came here for. And out of your experience were you to create yourself. You have created yourself out of the experience of others. If there were such a thing as sin, this would be it. To allow yourself to become what you are because of the experience of others. This is the sin you have committed, all of you. You do not await your own experience. You accept the experience of others as gospel, literally. And then when you encounter the actual experience for the first time, you overlay what you think you already know onto the encounter. If you did not do this, you might have a wholly different experience, one that might render your original teacher or source wrong. In most cases, you don't want to make your parents, your schools, your religions, your traditions, your holy scriptures wrong, so you deny your own experience in favor of what you have been told to think. Nowhere can this be more profoundly illustrated than in your treatment of human sexuality. Everyone knows that the sexual experience can be the single most loving, most exciting, most powerful, most exhilarating, most renewing, most energizing, most affirming, most intimate, most uniting, most recreative physical experience of which humans are capable. Having discovered this experientially, you have chosen to accept instead the prior judgments, opinions, and ideas about sex promulgated by others, all of whom have a vested interest in how you think. These opinions, judgments, and ideas have run directly contradictory to your own experience, yet because you are loath to make your teachers wrong, you convince yourself it must be your experience that is wrong. The result is that you have betrayed your highest truth about this subject with devastating results. You have done the same thing with money. Every time in your life that you have had lots and lots of money, you felt great. You felt great receiving it, and you felt great spending it. There was nothing bad about it, nothing evil, nothing inherently wrong. Yet you have so deeply ingrained within you the teachings of others on this subject that you have rejected your experience in favor of truth. Having adopted this truth as your own, you have formed thoughts around it, thoughts which are creative. You have thus created a personal reality about money which pushes it away from you. For why would you seek to attract that which is not good? Amazingly, you have created the same contradiction around God. Everything your heart experiences about God tells you that God is good. Everything your teachers teach you about God tells you God is bad. Your heart tells you God is to be loved without fear. Your teachers tell you God is to be feared, for he is a vengeful God. You are to live in fear of God's wrath, they say. You are to tremble in his presence. Your whole life through, you are to fear the judgment of the Lord, for the Lord is just, you are told. And God knows you will be in trouble when you confront the terrible justice of the Lord. You are therefore to be obedient to God's commands, or else. Above all, you are not to ask such logical questions as, if God wanted strict obedience to his laws, why did he create the possibility of those laws being violated? Ah, your teachers tell you, because God wanted you to have free choice. Yet what kind of choice is free when to choose one thing over the other brings condemnation? How is free will free when it is not your will but someone else's which must be done? Those who teach you this would make a hypocrite of God. You are told that God is forgiveness and compassion. Yet if you do not ask for this forgiveness in the right way, if you do not come to God properly, your plea will not be heard. Your cry will go unheeded. Even this would not be so bad if there were only one proper way. But there are as many proper ways being taught as there are teachers to teach them. Most of you, therefore, spend the bulk of your adult life searching for the right way to worship, to obey, and to serve God. The irony of all this is that I do not want your worship. I do not need your obedience. And it is not necessary for you to serve me. These behaviors are the behaviors historically demanded of their subjects by monarchs, usually egomaniacal, insecure, tyrannical monarchs at that. They're not godly demands in any sense. And it seems remarkable that the world hasn't by now concluded that the demands are counterfeit, having nothing to do with the needs or desires of deity. Deity has no needs. All that is exactly that. All that is. It therefore wants or lacks nothing, by definition. If you choose to believe in a God who somehow needs something, and has such hurt feelings if he doesn't get it that he punishes those from whom he expected to receive it, then you choose to believe in a God much smaller than I am. You truly are children of a lesser God. No, my children, please let me assure you again that I am without needs. I require nothing. This does not mean I am without desires. Desires and needs are not the same thing, although many of you have made them so in your present lifetime. Desire is the beginning of all creation. It is first thought. It is a grand feeling within the soul. It is God choosing what next to create. And what is God's desire? I desire first to know and experience myself in all my glory. To know who I am. Before I invented you and all the worlds of the universe, it was impossible for me to do so. Second, I desire that you shall know and experience who you really are through the power I have given you to create and experience yourself in whatever way you choose. Third, I desire for the whole life process to be an experience of constant joy continuous creation, never-ending expansion, and total fulfillment in each moment of now. I have established a perfect system whereby these desires may be realized. They are being realized now, in this very moment. The only difference between you and me is that I know this. In the moment of your total knowing, which moment could come upon you at any time, you too will feel as I do always, totally joyful, loving, accepting, blessing, and grateful. These are the five attitudes of God. And before we are through with this dialogue, I will show you how the application of these attitudes in your life now can and will bring you to godliness. All of this is a very long answer to a very short question. Yes, hold to your values, so long as you experience that they serve you. Yet look to see whether the values you serve with your thoughts, words, and actions bring to the space of your experience the highest and best idea you ever had about you. Examine your values one by one. Hold them up to the light of public scrutiny. If you can tell the world who you are and what you believe without breaking stride or hesitating, you are happy with yourself. There is no reason to continue much further in this dialogue with me, because you have created a self and a life for the self, which needs no improvement. You have reached perfection.
Well, my life is not perfect, nor is it close to being perfect. I am not perfect. I am, in fact, a bundle of imperfections. Sometimes I wish with all my heart, that I could correct these imperfections, that I could know what causes my behaviors, what sets up my downfalls, what keeps getting in my way. That's why I've come to you, I guess. I haven't been able to find the answers on my own.
I'm glad you came. I've always been here to help you. I'm here now.
You don't have to find the answers on your own. You never had to.
Yet it seems so presumptuous to simply sit down and dialogue with you this way, much less imagine that you, God, are responding. I mean, this is crazy.
I see. The authors of the Bible were all sane, but you are crazy.
The Bible writers were witnesses to the life of Christ and faithfully recorded what they heard and saw.
Correction. Most of the New Testament writers never met or saw Jesus in their lives. They lived many years after Jesus left the earth. They wouldn't have known Jesus of Nazareth if they walked into him on the street.
But
the Bible writers were great believers and great historians. They took the stories which had been passed down to them and to their friends by others, elders, from elder to elder, until finally a written record was made. And not everything of the Bible authors was included in the final document. Already churches had sprung up around the teachings of Jesus. And as it happens, whenever and wherever people gather in groups around a powerful idea, there were certain individuals within these churches or enclaves who determined what parts of the Jesus story were going to be told and how. This process of selecting and editing continued throughout the gathering, writing, and publishing of the Gospels and the Bible. Even several centuries after the original scriptures were committed to writing, a high council of the church determined yet one more time which doctrines and truths were to be included in the then official Bible, and which would be unhealthy or premature to reveal to the masses. And there have been other holy scriptures as well, each placed in writing in moments of inspiration by otherwise ordinary men, none of whom were any more crazy than you. But let's drive to the heart of your question. Why do you think it's crazy for you to be able to have a dialogue with God? Do you not believe in prayer?
Yes, of course, but that's different. Prayer for me has always been one way. I ask, and God remains immutable.
God has never answered a prayer?
Oh, yes, of course, but never verbally, you see. Oh, I've had all kinds of things happen in my life that I was convinced was an answer, a very direct answer to prayer. But God has never spoken to me.
I see. So this God in which you believe, this God can do anything. It just cannot speak.
Of course God can speak, if God wants to. It just doesn't seem probable that God would speak to me, that God would want to speak to me.
This is the root of every problem you experience in your life, for you do not consider yourself worthy enough to be spoken to by God. Good heavens, how can you ever expect to hear my voice if you don't imagine yourself to be deserving enough to even be spoken to? I tell you this, I am performing a miracle right now, for not only am I speaking to you, but to every person who is listening to these words. To each of them am I now speaking. I know who every one of them is. I know now who will find their way to these words. And I know that, just as with all my other communications, some will be able to hear, and some will be able to only listen, or will hear nothing.
I have 100 questions, you know, 1,000, 1,000,000. And the problem is, I sometimes don't know where to begin.
Just start somewhere. Go ahead, right now.
When will my life finally take off? What does it take to get it together and achieve even a modicum of success? Can the struggle ever end?
Good. Now we're getting to it. Don't apologize for these questions. These are the questions men and women have been asking for hundreds of years. The questions were so silly they wouldn't be asked over and over again by each succeeding generation. So let's go to question one. I've established laws in the universe that make it possible for you to have, to create, exactly what you choose. These laws cannot be violated, nor can they be ignored. You are following these laws right now, even as you listen to this. You cannot not follow the law, for these are the way things work. You cannot step aside from this. You cannot operate outside of it. Every minute of your life, you have been operating inside of it, and everything you have ever experienced, you have thusly created. You are in a partnership with God. We share an eternal covenant. My promise to you is to always give you what you ask. Your promise is to ask, to understand the process of the asking and the answering. I've already explained this process to you once. I'll do so again so that you clearly understand it. You are a threefold being. You consist of body, mind, and spirit. You could also call these the physical, the non-physical, and the metaphysical. This is the Holy Trinity, and it has been called by many names. That which you are, I am. I am manifested as three in one. Some of your theologians have called this Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Your psychiatrists have recognized this triumvirate and called it conscious, subconscious, and superconscious. Your philosophers have called it the id, the ego, and the superego. Science calls this energy, matter, and antimatter. Poets speak of mind, heart, and soul. New Age thinkers refer to body, mind, and spirit. Your time is divided into past, present, and future. Could this not be the same as subconscious, conscious, and superconscious? Space is likewise divided into three, here, there, and the space between. It is defining and describing this space between that becomes difficult, elusive. The moment you begin defining or describing, the space you describe becomes here or there. Yet we know this space between exists. It is what holds here and there in place, just as the eternal now holds before and after in place. These three aspects of you are actually three energies. You might call them thought, word, and action. All three put together produce a result, which in your language and understanding is called feeling or experience. Your soul, subconscious, id, spirit, past, is the sum total of every feeling you've ever had. Created. Your awareness of some of these is called your memory. When you have a memory, you are said to remember. That is, to put back together, to reassemble the parts. When you reassemble all of the parts of you, you will have remembered who you really are. The process of creation starts with thought, an idea, conception, visualization. Everything you see was once someone's idea. Nothing exists in your world that did not first exist as pure thought. This is true of the universe as well. Thought is the first level of creation. Next comes the word. Everything you say is a thought expressed. It is creative and sends forth creative energy into the universe. Words are more dynamic, thus some might say more creative than thought, because words are a different level of vibration from thought. They disrupt, change, alter, affect the universe with greater impact. Words are the second level of creation. Next comes action. Actions are words moving. Words are thoughts expressed. Thoughts are ideas formed. Ideas are energies come together. Energies are forces released. Forces are elements existent. Elements are particles of God, portions of all, the stuff of everything. The beginning is God. The end is action. Action is God creating or God experienced. Your thought about yourself is that you are not good enough, not wondrous enough, not sinless enough to be a part of God, in partnership with God. You have denied for so long who you are that you have forgotten who you are. This has not occurred by coincidence. This is not happenstance. It is all part of the divine plan. For you could not claim, create, experience who you are if you already were it. It was necessary first for you to release, deny, forget your connection to me in order to fully experience it by fully creating it, by calling it forth. For your grandest wish and my grandest desire was for you to experience yourself as the part of me you are. You are therefore in the process of experiencing yourself by creating yourself anew in every single moment, as am I, through you. Do you see the partnership? Do you grasp its implications? It is a holy collaboration, truly, a holy communion. Life will take off for you, then, when you choose for it to. You have not so chosen as yet. You have procrastinated, prolonged, protracted, protested. Now it's time that you promulgated and produced what you have been promised. To do this, you must believe the promise and live it. You must live the promise of God. The promise of God is that you are his son, her offspring, its likeness, his equal. Here's where you get hung up. You can accept his son, offspring, likeness, but you recoil at being called his equal. It is too much to accept. Too much bigness, too much wonderment, too much responsibility. For if you are God's equal, that means nothing is being done to you and all things are created by you. There can be no more victims, no more villains, only outcomes of your thought about a thing. I tell you this, all you see in your world is the outcome of your idea about it. Do you want your life to truly take off? Then change your idea about it, about you. Think, speak, and act as the God you are. Of course, this will separate you from many. Most of your fellow men. They will call you crazy. They will say you blaspheme. They will eventually have enough of you. They will attempt to crucify you. They will do this not because they think you are living in a world of your own illusions. Most men are gracious enough to allow you your private entertainments. But because sooner or later others will become attracted to your truth, by the promises it holds for them. Here is where your fellow men will interfere. For here is where you will begin to threaten them. For your simple truth, simply lived, will offer more beauty, more comfort, more peace, more joy, and more love of self and others than anything your earthly fellows could contrive. And that truth adopted would mean the end of their ways. It would mean the end of hatred and fear and bigotry and war. The end of the condemning and killing that has gone on in my name. The end of might is right. The end of purchase through power. The end of loyalty and homage through fear. The end of the world as they know it, and as you have created it thus far. So be ready, kind soul. where you will be vilified and spat upon, called names and deserted, and finally they will accuse you, try you, and condemn you, all in their own ways, from the moment you accept and adopt your holy cause, the realization of self. Why then do it? Because you are no longer concerned with the acceptance or approval of the world. You are no longer satisfied with what that has brought you. You are no longer pleased with what it has given others. You want the pain to stop, the suffering to stop, the illusion to end. You have had enough of this world as it presently is. You seek a newer world. Seek it no longer. Now, call it forth.
Yes, well, can you help me to better understand how to do that?
Yes. Go first to your highest thought about yourself. Imagine the you that you would be if you lived that thought every day. Imagine what you would think, do, and say, and how you would respond to what others do and say. Do you see any difference between that projection and what you think, do, and say now?
Yes. Yes, I see a great deal of difference.
Good. You should, since we know that right now you are not living your highest vision of yourself. Now, having seen the differences between where you are and where you want to be, begin to change. Consciously change your thoughts, words, and actions to match your grandest vision. This will require tremendous mental and physical effort. It will entail constant, moment-to-moment monitoring of your every thought, word, and deed. It will involve continued choice-making, consciously. This whole process is a massive move to consciousness. What you will find out if you undertake this challenge is that you've spent half your life unconscious. That is to say, unaware on a conscious level of what you are choosing in the way of thoughts, words, and deeds until you experience the aftermath of them. Then when you experience these results, you deny that your thoughts, words, and deeds had anything to do with them. This is a call to stop such unconscious living. It is a challenge to which your soul has called you from the beginning of time.
That kind of continual mental monitoring seems as though it might be terribly exhausting.
It could be, until it becomes second nature. In fact, it is your second nature. It is your first nature to be unconditionally loving. It is your second nature to choose to express your first nature, your true nature, consciously.
Excuse me, but wouldn't this kind of non-stop editing of everything I think, say, and do make Jack a dull boy?
Never. Different, yes. Dull, no. Was Jesus dull? I don't think so. Was the Buddha boring to be around? People flocked, begged to be in his presence. No one who's attained mastery is dull. Unusual, perhaps. Extraordinary, perhaps, but never dull. So, do you want your life to take off? Begin at once to imagine it the way you want it to be, and move into that. Check every thought, word, and action that does not fall into harmony with that. Move away from those. When you have a thought that is not in alignment with your higher vision, change to a new thought, then and there. When you say a thing that is out of alignment with your grandest idea, make a note not to say something like that again. When you do a thing that is misaligned with your best intention, decide to make that the last time. And make it right with whomever was involved, if you can.
I've heard this before, but I've always railed against it because it seems so dishonest. I mean, if you're sick as a dog, you're not supposed to admit it. If you're broke as a pauper, you're never supposed to say it. If you're upset as hell, you're not supposed to show it. Reminds me of the joke about the three people who were sent to hell. One was a Catholic, one was a Jew, one was a New Ager. The devil said to the Catholic, sneeringly, "Well, how are you enjoying the heat?" And the Catholic sniffed, I'm offering it up." The devil then asked the Jew, "And how are you enjoying the heat?" The Jew said, "So what else could I expect but more hell?" Finally, the devil approached the New Ager. "Heat?" the New Ager asked, perspiring. "What heat?"
"It's a good joke. But I'm not talking about ignoring the problem or pretending it isn't there. I'm talking about noticing the circumstance and then telling your highest truth about it. If you're broke, you're broke. It's pointless to lie about it and actually debilitating to try to manufacture a story about it so as not to admit it. Yet it's your thought about it. Broke is bad. This is horrible. I'm a bad person because good people who work hard and really try never go broke, etc. That rules how you experience brokenness. It's your words about it. I'm broke. I haven't a dime. I don't have any money. That dictates how long you stay broke. It's your actions surrounding it. Feeling sorry for yourself, sitting around despondent, not trying to find a way out because what's the use anyway? That creates your long-term reality. The first thing to understand about the universe is that no condition is good or bad. It just is. So stop making value judgments. The second thing to know is that all conditions are temporary. Nothing stays the same. Nothing remains static. Which way a thing changes depends on you.
Excuse me, but I have to interrupt you here again. What about the person who's sick, but has the faith that will move mountains and so thinks, says, believes he's going to get better, only to die 6 weeks later? How does that square with all this positive thinking, affirmative action stuff?
That's good. You're asking the tough questions. You're not simply taking my word for any of this. There is a place on down the line when you'll have to take my word for this, because eventually you'll find that we can discuss this thing forever, you and I, until there's nothing left to do but try it or deny it. But we're not at that place yet. So let's keep the dialogue going. Let's keep talking. The person who has the faith to move mountains and dies 6 weeks later has moved mountains for 6 weeks. That may have been enough for him. He may have decided on the last hour of the last day, okay, I've had enough. I'm ready to go on now to another adventure. You may not have known of that decision because he may not have told you. The truth is, he may have made that decision quite a bit earlier, days, weeks earlier, and not have told you, not have told anyone. You have created a society in which it is very not okay to want to die. Very not okay to be very okay with death. Because you don't want to die, you can imagine anyone wanting to die, no matter what their circumstances or condition. But there are many situations in which death is preferable to life, which I know you can imagine if you think about it for even a little bit. If these truths don't occur to you, they're not that self-evident when you are looking in the face of someone else who is choosing to die. And the dying person knows this. She can feel the level of acceptance in the room regarding her decision. Have you ever noticed how many people wait until the room is empty before they die? Some even have to tell their loved ones, "No, really, go. Get a bite to eat. Or go get some sleep. I'm fine. I'll see you in the morning." And then when the loyal guard leaves, so does the soul from the body of the guarded. If they told their assembled relatives and friends, "I just want to die," they would really hear it. "Oh, you don't mean that." Or, "Now, don't talk that way." Or, "Hang in there." Or, "Please don't leave me." The entire medical profession is trained to keep people alive, rather than keeping people comfortable so that they can die with dignity. You see, to a doctor or a nurse, death is failure. To a friend or relative, death is disaster. Only to the soul is death a relief, a release. The greatest gift you can give the dying is to let them die in peace, not thinking that they must hang on or continue to suffer or worry about you at this most crucial passage in their life. So this is very often what has happened in the case of the dying who says he's going to live, believes he's going to live, even prays to live, that at the soul level he has changed his mind. It is time now to drop the body to free the soul for other pursuits. When the soul makes this decision, nothing the body does can change it. Nothing the mind thinks can alter it. It is at the moment of death that we learn who in the body-mind-soul triumvirate is running things. All your life you think you are your body. Some of the time you think you are your mind. It is at the time of your death that you find out who you really are. Now, there are also times when the body and the mind are just not listening to the soul. This, too, creates the scenario you describe. The most difficult thing for people to do is hear their own soul. Notice that so few do. Now, it happens often that the soul makes a decision that it is time to leave the body. The body and the mind, ever servants of the soul, hear this, and the process of extrication begins. Yet the mind, ego, doesn't want to accept. After all, this is the end of its existence. So it instructs the body to resist death. This the body does gladly, since it too does not want to die. The body and the mind, ego, receive great encouragement, great praise for this from the outside world, the world of its creation. So the strategy is confirmed. Now at this point, everything depends on how badly the soul wants to leave. If there's no great urgency here, the soul may say, all right, you win. I'll stick around with you a little longer. But if the soul is very clear that staying does not serve its higher agenda, that there is no further way it can evolve through this body, the soul is going to leave, and nothing will stop it. Nor should anything try to. The soul is very clear that its purpose is evolution. That is its sole purpose, and its sole purpose. It is not concerned with the achievements of the body or the development of the mind. These are all meaningless to the soul. The soul is also clear that there is no great tragedy involved in leaving the body. In many ways, the tragedy is being in the body. So you have to understand, the soul sees this whole death thing differently. It, of course, sees the whole life thing differently, too. And that is the source of much of the frustration and anxiety one feels in one's life. The frustration and anxiety comes from not listening to one's soul.